Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Rob, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Colorectal Cancer. And today's program is being done in coordination with the Colorectal Cancer Alliance, so we're delighted to be working with them, and you'll be hearing more from them shortly. And today's program is being supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Taiho Oncology, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. And now we have many of you on the call today. There are over 200 participants on the call today, so you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. So we have over 200 of you on the call. And you, and also you come from many different parts of this country. We have the United States, from urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And you also come from some international countries, including Canada, Iraq, Pakistan, Puerto Rico, and the United Kingdom. So it's really a bit of a global call as well. And I would like to introduce this call and have you all know that we're delighted that you're all with us today. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Al Benson III. Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director for Cooperative Groups, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center of Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson will be addressing an overview of colorectal cancer in the context of COVID, Omicron, and seasonal flu and allergies. He'll also address current standard of care and new treatment approaches. He'll also be addressing predicting response to treatment, including staging and biomarker testing, and the role of precision medicine, including heritable and non-heritable genetic and genomic testing. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a pleasure to join all of you today. I'm going to briefly touch on the first topic about COVID and to mention that certainly for more than 3 years, we have been trying to deal with COVID and the aftermath of such. This has led to decrease in cancer screening, delays in treatment, as well as monitoring after treatment. And delays in screening have been particularly worrisome because of the potential to diagnose cancers, including colorectal cancer, in later stages. And our health system has made tremendous efforts to try to catch up to appropriately screen and care for our patients. We've also had some other hurdles, including our supply chain. So, for example, we had a shortage of iodinated contrast for CT scans, and this, too, resulted in delays, and we had to change strategies, for example, to use MRIs and or non-contrast CT scans, which might be less robust in terms of assessment. But we have moved forward, and for example, now we're no longer routinely testing asymptomatic individuals for COVID in terms of when they come in for treatment. But we're very mindful of infections, and in particular, we'll have to see what the fall and winter brings forward in terms of flu, other infections such as respiratory syncytial virus, certainly COVID, and to urge our patients to be appropriately vaccinated. In fact, the FDA just approved a vaccine for RSV, particularly for older individuals. So I think we're all going to be working with our patients for appropriate vaccination and care and monitoring. To move a little bit forward now, I'm going to focus a great deal overall in terms of treatment and precision medicine, and certainly Dr. Saltz will have more to address in terms of this topic. But one striking area of advancement across many cancer types, including colorectal cancer, is research at understanding the role of our immune systems play in the development of cancers, which has led to the development of specific immunotherapeutic drugs. In colorectal cancer, the most frequent current use of immunotherapy is for patients who have alterations in what's known as the DNA mismatch repair pathway. Pathologists now routinely report alterations when evaluating a colorectal cancer tumor under the microscope, and nowadays all colorectal cancer patients should know their mismatch repair or what's known as MSI status. Very briefly, microsatellites are short repeating DNA sequences across the human genome. And these sequences are actually very prone to errors. And there are genes that routinely can correct these errors. However, if a tumor has deficient mismatch repair proteins or microsatellite instability, these errors are not corrected and a tumor can develop. These mismatch repair genes can be altered through germline or inherited mutations, which I'll come back to in just a few minutes, or by non-inherited loss of expression. About 15% of colorectal cancers have deficient mismatch repair, and most of these are sporadic or non-inherited. Most patients with this phenomenon have earlier stage disease and do very well after surgery, but about 5% of cases have advanced or metastatic disease. The good news, though, is that for patients with deficient mismatch repair, immunotherapeutic agents known as checkpoint inhibitors have shown significant benefit for those with metastatic disease and have become the mainstay approach. And also, more recently, there have been studies, including with Dr. Saltz, that have shown in rectal cancer, giving immunotherapy may result in really remarkable responses. Despite these advances, though, there's still much we do not know, and clinical trials continue to help us learn more about the immune systems and the use of these immunotherapeutics. Another somewhat related area of research is investigations of the human microbiome, which consists of the microorganisms, particularly bacteria, that are a component of the intestinal tract and essential for health, including our immune systems. We know the human microbiome has evolved in recent years and is likely contributing to the development of cancer. So, for example, the yearly increase in numbers of younger people developing colorectal cancer may be linked to these changes in the microbiome, at least in part. So for patients with stage 1, 2, or 3 colorectal cancer, the most important biological test is looking for mismatch repair proteins or microsatellite instability. For patients with advanced, recurrent, or metastatic disease, we routinely evaluate patient tumors and or what are referred to as liquid biopsies, looking at circulating DNA in the blood. For other genomic or molecular changes that are now linked to specific treatments. Increasingly, this assessment is performed by what's known as next-generation sequencing, or NGS, that can evaluate hundreds of genes within tumor DNA, including relatively rare events, such as what are known as NTRK fusions, for which there are now specific treatments, and Dr. Saltz may address some of these. The most commonly identified observed changes, including what are known as RAS mutations in over 40% of individuals, BRAF mutations in about 10% of people, and for those with non-mutated RAS, known as wild-type RAS, we also look for what's known as HER2 expression. Again, we do have treatments that can address these particular events. For those with RAS mutations, we know that the anti-EGFR drugs, cetuximab and panitumumab, will not work, as these do for people who have RAS wild type. Until recently, we actually have not had drugs for people with RAS mutations, but this is now changing, and clinical trials are now reporting positive results for subtypes of RAS mutations, for example, for what's known as a G12C mutation. We also have combination therapy for BRAF mutated patients, as well as those with the high HER2 expressing tumors. Just returning back quickly to the patients with deficient mismatch repair genes, as I alluded to, the majority of individuals do not have inherited colorectal cancer, but it is also important to identify these individuals since they are the people most likely to benefit from immunotherapy. In addition, for those with inherited cancers, they differ in terms of surgical considerations, type of surveillance after treatment is complete, and the need to test family members, since those who are positive by testing do need to have genetic counseling and appropriate screening for those who are positive. Those who do have inherited cancers most often have what we call Lynch syndrome, and the tumor test we look for is this MSI microsatellite instability or this deficient mismatch repair. I think with that, I'll conclude some of my remarks with one of the more recent advances in colorectal cancer, which is a technology with the ability to locate circulating tumor DNA in a patient's blood, and on the basis of this, identifying potential treatment targets. But also there's interest in looking at circulating tumor DNA when we evaluate patients to see who might be most likely to recur from their original colorectal cancer and if treatment is being effective. This type of research is now actively being conducted through clinical trials, and we would certainly urge people to continue to participate in these trials whenever possible. This was just a quick, brief overview of some of the developments. It's certainly an exciting area of research, and we're hopeful this will translate into better and better strategies to help our patients with colorectal cancer. So with that, thank you, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Benson. That was just a wonderful presentation and very informative for our participants. And I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Leonard Saltz. Dr. Saltz is medical oncologist, executive director for clinical values and sustainability, head colorectal oncology section, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Saltz will be addressing the role of targeted cancer therapies, clinical trial updates, how research contributes to treatment options, preventing and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, quality of life concerns, follow-up appointments, and discussion of open notes. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Saltz.
Hello, everyone. A pleasure to have a chance to talk to you today. I'm going to follow Dr. Benson's discussion just by retouching on some of the points that he covered, just to elaborate on what I think are some of the most important ones and then move on to some of these other topics. What we're talking about with targeted therapy, I think it's important to understand, is looking for whether or not your particular tumor has a target that we know how to hit. And in that respect, when patients ask me, you know, about targeted therapies, what they're really asking about is the more advanced, newer approach to cancer, which is rather than giving everybody with a cancer from the colon or the rectum the same treatment, looking to see what we can understand about what makes that tumor tick. What is driving that tumor? What is sending grow and survive signals to the nucleus of those tumor cells? And what can we do to affect that in a way that's beneficial to our patients? When Dr. Benson mentions the idea of a mismatch repair deficient or a microsatellite instable tumor, what that tells us is that tumor has a lot of mutations. And if it has a lot of mutations, then it's making proteins that nature didn't intend, and the immune system can see that. And so that's why coming at it with an immunotherapy is beneficial to patients. Now, in this respect, this becomes a marker for a biomarker for patients with colorectal cancer. If mismatch repair deficient, then immunotherapy highly likely to be very beneficial. But there's a downside to that. If mismatch repair proficient or microsatellite stable, we have to acknowledge that's a type of cancer where at least thus far, immunotherapy doesn't work. And trying it is going to expose people to the risk and the toxicity and the expense without benefit. So targeted therapy or precision medicine, these terms kind of get mixed together, have both an upside and a downside. I would argue much more upside. The upside is they tell you when a treatment has a high likelihood of working. They also keep certain treatments from happening for patients simply because they tell us that realistically this is not something that's going to help this patient, and that lets us use that information to protect the patient from unnecessary toxicity. Now, some of these targets actually have what we would call a prognostic value, meaning that they give us a sense of whether this is going to be a more aggressive tumor that's going to be more dangerous quickly to the patient, or a slower growing tumor that's likely to have a better outcome. They also can be predictive of whether or not a particular treatment is going to be helpful. So Dr. Benson mentioned, for example, the gene BRAF, B-R-A-F. This is a gene that when it has a particular mutation, the common mutation that we see in about 8% of patients with colorectal cancer, that is a relatively worrisome prognosis. Those people as a group have a tumor that, without intervention, is going to do worse. But it also opens up a new avenue of opportunity because we now have combinations of drug therapies that specifically target BRAF. Those combinations are not useful unless BRAF is driving the tumor. And the BRAF would be driving the tumor if it has a specific mutation. And so this is how we use the technology in understanding what's going on in your cancer to come up with the therapy that's particularly right for you and to protect you from side effects and expense of treatment that doesn't have any realistic chance of being beneficial to you. Now, within the context of this, I think it's important to understand in colorectal cancer, for all practical purposes, this mutational pattern is established early on. And so if you've had surgery and we have a sample of tumor, or if we have a biopsy of tumor from the beginning of your cancer journey, realistically, that tells us what we need to know. We're not realistically expecting that there's going to be meaningful changes in terms of the picture, but it does tell us what kinds of opportunities might be out there in terms of your treatment. Now, Dr. Benson mentioned clinical trials, and that is something that those of us in the cancer care and cancer research community believe in deeply. These are opportunities for you as a patient to access technology at an earlier phase before we have a clear understanding of just how good it is and how safe it is. And so in each circumstance where you might consider a clinical trial, what we have to do is think about, well, what are the alternatives? And so what I and most of my colleagues try to do when we're talking to a patient about treatment options is first outline what are our best standard options within the context of non-research, non-clinical trial. What could we offer you? What decision would we make? Then, in that scenario, let's now discuss, do we have a clinical trial available that makes sense for you? And if we do, let's talk about, well, what are the relative risks? What are the relative benefits? Why might a person choose to go on that clinical trial? Why might a person not choose to go on that clinical trial? Now, I do think it's important to understand, because people are often disappointed by unrealistic expectations, clinical trials have very rigid eligibility criteria. These are not something that a doctor has any latitude on. These are really kind of firmly set in stone. And one of those criteria is typically what we call a performance status. And performance status is how doctors talk to each other to say, how medically well is this patient versus how frail and sick is this patient. People that are very weak, very advanced disease, people that have problems with kidney function or liver function or low blood counts, they're not going to be eligible for almost all clinical trials. And so it's important to understand that accessing of clinical trials and thinking about clinical trials is something that one wants to be talking about throughout the continuum of care, whereas too often people think, well, let me try all the standard treatments first and then look for a clinical trial. And in that scenario, there may or may not be a clinical trial available, and an individual patient may or may not qualify for that clinical trial. So that's something to keep in mind when thinking about your choices. And of course, it's something that you always want to be asking your provider about. What are my clinical trial options in addition to what are my standard options? Now, one of the topics I've been asked to talk about today is dealing with side effects. All of the treatments that we have the potential for side effects. And different drugs, different chemotherapy agents have different side effect profiles. What we as clinicians do is try to anticipate those problems and head them off. So, for example, one of the things that we all worry about the most with a lot of cancer therapies is nausea and vomiting. Everybody knows that's a very unpleasant thing. We want to do everything in our power to keep that from happening. And what when we give drugs that predispose people to nausea and vomiting, we'll have very powerful anti-nausea medicines that are going to be administered first, usually intravenously, and then in addition we'll have some oral medicines that people can have as a take-home for kind of a safety valve if there's a breakthrough. Other side effects are often controlled either by treating the symptoms. Diarrhea, for example, may be treated with antidiarrheal agents, or by holding or slowing down the schedule of the chemotherapy. So if you have side effects that are beyond what is acceptable, then your doctor is going to make dose adjustments. And so it's really important in terms of the side effects to be proactive in talking with your doctor or your provider about what problems are you worried about, what problems are you having, what works for you, and what doesn't work. Now, this program began with a discussion of dealing with the various issues of COVID and the pandemic. And although we've made an awful lot of progress in terms of that area, and it did set a lot of care back, as Dr. Benson mentioned, there has been one real positive, probably the only positive, that came out of the COVID epidemic, and that is the advancement of telemedicine, which I think the COVID epidemic really moved that process forward about a decade in a one-month period. And so whereas a few years ago, telemedicine was just a small, rare backwater that most people weren't using, during the worst of the COVID crisis, many of us were doing virtually all of our care by telemedicine, and so we've gotten very good at it and very comfortable with it, and this can be a real asset for patients, especially if you live some distance from your doctor or if your doctor is an area that has a lot of traffic and difficulty getting to and so on. Now, telemedicine is not a telephone call. It is video and audio, and that's a critically important part. We really can't do good medical care just over the telephone. But when we can see the patient, when we can see their facial expressions, when we can see their eyes, when we can see their body language, when we can really have that conversation where we get all of those cues, plus we've learned how to really examine patients and get much of the information we need from a video interview, we can do most of what we need as medical oncologists over video, and that can save patients a lot of time and travel, and that can make life a lot easier for people. But there are certain basics that you need to think about. One is you need to have the appropriate electronic equipment. You need to have a computer with a camera, or you need to have a smartphone, and you need to be in an area with good internet connection. If you don't have an adequate internet connection, it's a setup for failure to try to do telemedicine. It's always a good idea, if you're going to do telemedicine with your provider, to do a test run before your clinic appointment, either some days before or at least 5 or 10 minutes before the scheduled appointment, to let the office work with you to try to make sure that you've got a good two-way connection. It's a good idea to have an understanding, well, what's my backup? If my computer doesn't work, am I going to use my smartphone? What kind of programs are we going to use, and how are we going to do that? For older patients that are less comfortable with computers, it may be important for family members or caregivers to be available to assist with that technology. It's very frustrating to patient and doctor if we set up a telemedicine and we can't get that communication that we were counting on. Whether you're doing telemedicine or whether you're coming in person, it's really important to be prepared for your appointment by thinking about what are the issues you want to cover. We as doctors will have an idea what we think is important. We're going to try to anticipate what's important to you, but we can't always tell. And it's going to be really important that you make a list of questions and make sure that you get your questions covered in that telemedicine visit or in an office visit. Often the issue of how the treatments are affecting your quality of life, what your priorities are, what you're willing to accept, what you're not willing to accept, are critically important points that you need to make sure that you feel comfortable bringing up in these discussions. You need to know when you get off one appointment, when is the next one happening? If you get off a telemedicine, when are you coming in for your chemotherapy? Or when are you coming in for a scan? Or when are you going to next be seen in person? When is your next telemedicine? These are things you want to make sure that you have a clear idea about. The last topic that I was asked to talk about is the concept of open notes and electronic accessibility. This is a well-intentioned aspect of the Affordable Care Act that I think has some upside but some potential downside for patients, and so it's really important to understand that virtually all major centers are now being required to provide not only all of the doctor's notes but all of your path reports, all of your scan reports, all of your tests on available to you electronically virtually immediately as the information becomes available. Now, of course, when it's good news, that's a lovely thing, when it's clear. But all too often, it's not so clear. All too often, there's a fair amount of jargon and verbiage there that can look very intimidating, can sound scary, may or may not mean anything. Sometimes there's bad news on a scan or a report, and that's something that we as doctors, I think, work hard to put in context and try to help patients understand within the context of disappointing news, what are our options, what are we going to do about it, how are we going to regain control of the situation. So just be aware that there is a potential upside and a potential downside to you in accessing the information directly without the provider there to explain it to you and to answer your questions. And know yourself, make your own decisions about whether you're better off getting that information and then waiting until you have your appointment to have an explanation of it, or whether you might feel more comfortable waiting until the doctor presents it to you in the context of what the care plans are. So I'm going to stop there so we leave some time for questions today. Thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Saltz. That was really also outstanding and a wonderful presentation. And I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden. And Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian with the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center. And Ms. Bearden will be addressing nutrition and hydration concerns and tips, which I know is a very, very important topic for all of you. So I'm going to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are essential. They're essential to the way our body functions, how we feel, our tolerance to treatment, providing us the energy to do the things that we enjoy. So it's very important that you feel comfortable with your diet during treatment. If you're experiencing any side effects that change from your baseline, from the how things were doing before treatment as to how you're doing during treatment, reach out to your healthcare team and communicate with them you're having questions about diet or you're having these issues so that we can help support you sooner rather than later. Now, your diet might be modified. It might be modified even before starting treatment or during your treatment or even after your treatment. Modifications are based on your unique needs, and this is where it becomes so important. We've heard it today already, the value of communicating with your healthcare team, making a list of questions and issues in between visits, so that when you come to the visit that you can feel like you've had all your questions answered. Some potential side effects that a patient may experience during treatment for colorectal cancer include things like constipation, diarrhea, maybe nausea and vomiting, maybe a change in taste or decreased appetite, an increase in fatigue. Not everybody will experience these, and not everybody will have the same level of experience with these if they experience them, but irregardless, it's important to let your team know. Now, there are medications. We heard a little bit earlier today about some side effect medications that might be provided. And so when a physicians preparing you for a treatment, they'll go over the potential side effects of the treatment. They may make some prescription orders for you to pick up for these side effects. Understand how to use this medication. It's very important that you feel comfortable even asking the doctor to explain it back to you or you write it down. For example, for nausea medication, appreciating, okay, is this a scheduled medication or do I take it just when I have nausea? These are questions that you can ask your doctor, and based on what your unique plan is, they can answer those questions for you. Now, a dietitian is part of your healthcare team, and the dietitian is somebody who is a resource for you. We can provide you information on your calorie, protein, goals, your fluid needs, modifications of diet based on your unique situation. If you are having a surgical intervention, if you have an ostomy placed, you may also work with a wound ostomy nurse. Make sure that you feel comfortable with the tools and how to modify your diet based on any surgical intervention you go through. A lot of patients, you know, tell me, oh, I have weight to lose, I don't need to worry about it. And, you know, we kind of joke about that a little bit, you know, on the side in our everyday life with those around us. But the truth of it is, when you're going through cancer treatment, it's very important that we are aware of any unintentional weight loss that you may experience, or even weight gain. Weight is one tool that we use to help get an idea if you're getting enough nutrition in. But one of the things that we also know is that even if you're overweight, you are still at risk of becoming malnourished. Malnutrition isn't something that we're familiar with in our everyday life. And so when you're going through cancer treatment, some of the concerns, if a patient's going through a challenge with their intake and not able to maintain their weight, is that they'll lose muscle mass. And our muscle mass is something that gives us the ability to do the things that we enjoy. It's what gives us the endurance to get up and move around and get up out of chairs and just be active in the way that you enjoy being active. And so communication with your healthcare team, again, is so important. If there are any changes in your tolerance to diet, any changes in your weight that are unintentional, please don't hesitate to connect with them as soon as possible. Now, we did hear a little bit ago about keeping a record, not only of questions, but of any changes that you're going through. Sometimes it's something that comes on every now and then, and it may not be something that's on the forefront of your mind when you're seeing your healthcare team, but take note of it and say, you know, it doesn't happen all the time, but I'm going through this. Is this something I need to be concerned about? And your healthcare team can help identify, is this something that we need to address? Now, we talk a lot about nutrition and eating and maintaining weight, but hydration is also very important, and dehydration can actually amplify some of the side effects that you might experience, such as nausea and fatigue and constipation. But fluid is anything that's liquid at room temperature, things like water, milk, and sports drinks. In general, most patients need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day, but treatments such as radiation and other you know, maybe chemotherapies or even post-surgical may require a modification to this guideline. It may increase it or it may decrease it. So be sure to be in touch with your healthcare team about any changes based on your treatment plan. So in closing, there are several members of the healthcare team. We're all dedicated to you, and we're here to help support you. Know how to reach your team members, know what their function is, and how to navigate so that you can get the help that you need as quickly as possible. On that note, I'm going to hand it back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Diana. That was a wonderful presentation, just really excellent. And I know there are always questions for you during the Q&A, so because people are always concerned about their diet and nutrition, so and hydration. So I know there'll be questions for you as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Angel Russell, and Ms. Russell is Director of Partnerships Colorectal Cancer Alliance, and we are partnering with them today on today's program. And Ms. Russell will be describing the Colorectal Cancer Alliance's free programs and services, as well as their helpline and website and the services that they offer. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Russell.
Thank you so much, and thank you to the cancer care community for partnering with us on this important call. We are the Colorectal Cancer Alliance, and while we exist in colorectal cancer in our lifetime, our heart and soul are with patients, families, and their caregivers. Our team provides 360 support to really help patients live better with colorectal cancer. And that's done specifically through our care pillar, which we will highlight today over the next couple of minutes, our BlueHQ platform, and through our certified bilingual live navigators for patients and for screening. And so the Colorectal Cancer Alliance was founded in 1999 by more than 40 patient advocates. And our work is organized through three pillars: screen, care, and cure. Today, I'll be focusing on our services under the care pillar. And so the care pillar is made up of amazing live patient navigators who really help to address any gaps in care that exist outside of the doctor's office. So when you think about needing to get the correct nutritional support, when you think about financial support and just really psychosocial support, the Colorectal Cancer Alliance is here for those patients. So our patient and family support team, we have a helpline that is available with live patient navigators. We also have web chats that are available for patients to actually just help each other through their journey. We also have a buddy program that allows people to connect with other patients who are in a similar space in their journey to really provide resources to one another and, again, that psychosocial support that's needed. We also have financial assistance available in the form of Blue Hope Awards, which provides a dollar amount to patients who need it to help them address any other insecurity that they have, such as financial insecurity. When you think about sometimes just keeping the lights on can become an issue for people going through a cancer journey. And so the Alliance wants to be there to help with that as well. We also have task forces that are available. We have a Never Too Young task force, which is comprised of amazing patients who were diagnosed under the age of 50. We ensure that they have the support, the unique support that they need, a lot of times involving childcare, how to navigate cancer while you're working. We also have a BOSS task force, which is comprised of folks who need information about how to activate in communities of color and in other marginalized communities. That group comes together to ensure that the Alliance's messaging is culturally responsible, but then also that we're meeting people where they are. All of this information, including our resource guides, which are available on our website, are available through our BlueHQ platform. The BlueHQ platform, we created it because there's so much information out there on the internet, some good, some bad, some reliable, some not. And so we wanted to pull all of the information that a colorectal cancer patient would need into one place, into a personalized space. And so when we think about the need for precision medicine and precision support to really improve survival and improve the quality of life, and then we also think about the need to meet people where they are and then also collect real world evidence and cutting-edge data, we created BlueHQ to do all of that. So it's a personalized support hub, one-stop shop for all the resources. There's live navigation support, discussion forums, data sharing, medical trackers, and incredibly an access to clinical trial information, which can be life-saving on so many different levels. So that information is available on BlueHQ.org, and any of the other information that I've spoken about today, plus so much more, is available on CCAlliance.org as well. And then I'm also available myself, Angel Russell. My email address is arussell@ccalliance.org. Very happy to chat with you and talk about how to partner or to get the resources that you need. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Russell. That was really a wonderful resource for everybody. So please, it's your go-to resource in addition to your healthcare team for all the resources that you might need. And now I'm just going to say a few words about the services you can access from Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national organization, provides free programs and services to people living with cancer. You can visit our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673. That Hope Line is often answered by oncology social workers. We have about 40 oncology social workers on staff, and they tend to answer the phone when you call. And indeed, usually people, when they call, have a specific question or concern. The oncology social worker will address that question and then provide them with all the other services we offer. So what are those services? So we do offer practical financial and co-payment assistance, which has made a tremendous difference in people's lives. Certainly, historically, since Cancer Care was founded in 1944, these services have been very important. In addition to that, we also offer support to people, a chance to talk with one of our oncology social workers. We also offer online support groups, and we offer publications, lots of different publications on different types of cancers. And we also offer these programs, we did about 80 of them last year, on different types of cancer and as well as different cancer topics. And we also have a pet assistance program, which I think our organization is very proud of, people who have a cat or dog, and perhaps because of their cancer treatment, they are not able to perhaps take their dog out for a walk or change the litter box. And we do assist with the cost of that particular care for people. And we do have a host of other services that you can access from our website, which is at www.cancercare.org. And although I know we have a number of international participants on the call today as well, many of our services are accessible to people internationally. The financial assistance and co-payment assistance programs, those are for people in the United States. And now we're going to move on to questions. I'm going to ask Rob to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Rob?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And we have a question from one of our participants, and I'm going to give this question to Dr. Benson to begin with. I'm a young person, 29 years old, who was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer. Personally, it took 6 months before we found the cancer. It was mentioned that younger and younger people are getting colorectal cancer. So what actions are being taken to detect cancer in young people sooner? For example, the age for a colonoscopy has been lowered to 45. Are there any plans to lower that even further? If you could start that with Dr. Benson, if you could begin with that question.
Yes, this topic of the increasing numbers of young people who are developing colorectal cancer is it's really important, and it is a challenge because currently, there are no definitive screening programs for a younger population. What is important, though, that we should stress is that people should know their family history very well, as much as they can. And if there's a history of colorectal cancer or other cancers in the family, it may be very important to talk with a genetic counselor to make sure that there isn't a family risk that would require earlier screening. Now, certainly, many of the younger people who are developing cancer do not have, at least with our current knowledge, an inherited risk. And there's a lot of interest, a lot of research to figure out what might be the risk factors for individuals to develop a cancer at an earlier age and what might be future screening mechanisms so that we can more efficiently and realistically test much larger populations of individuals. But I would also add that people should not ignore symptoms. So particularly if there's a symptom like bleeding, to go to your doctor immediately and discuss an appropriate evaluation. This is a challenge, but one that those of us in the research community are really trying to focus on and address.
Thank you. And Dr. Saltz, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I agree certainly with everything that Al said. It is, of course, very challenging because the vast majority of people in their 20s and 30s who have symptoms aren't going to have cancer. Our challenge, as Al said, is try to figure out how to accurately identify those who do. It's a vexing problem, but as mentioned, it's important for people to advocate for themselves, get evaluated early. Of course, not every symptom needs an immediate workup, but if things don't get better in a couple of weeks, then an evaluation with an endoscopy is warranted. So I think the medical community is becoming more and more aware of young onset cancers in general and young onset colon and rectal cancers in particular. So I hope that things are improving, but we've certainly got our work cut out for us to optimize this.
Thank you. For Ms. Bearden, do I need to follow a special diet after treatment?
Well, it depends on your treatment intervention. So if there's a surgical component, there might be a modification. If you had an ostomy, for example, placed, there might be some diet suggestions provided. If you're having any side effects or symptoms, there might be suggestions provided. A lot of times when patients are going through treatment, that's when a lot of their side effects would present themselves. And then what you would do is talk with your healthcare team and your dietitian about follow-up after that. As symptoms start to change or things start to improve, then modification based on that. So specialized diets are only intended to address an issue that the patient's having or a side effect they're experiencing. And so it would really just depend on what your needs are, but definitely keeping in touch with your healthcare team along the way will help answer those questions for you individually.
Thank you. And a question for Dr. Saltz. Is someone with an autoimmune disease such as Crohn's or celiac more susceptible to developing colorectal cancer?
Yes, unfortunately, Crohn's disease does have an increased risk of colorectal cancer. And so the gastroenterologists that are taking care of people with Crohn's are usually quite aware of this and monitoring for it. But unfortunately, yes, these autoimmune diseases do carry increased risk.
Excellent. And for Dr. Benson, is it possible for colorectal polyps and cancer to be found early, or is this a hard cancer to detect?
Certainly in most cases, a polyp is a precursor to development of a colorectal cancer. And so the purpose of screening guidelines is to evaluate people and identify a polyp, which in most cases can be removed by the gastroenterologist so that that polyp does not transform to a cancer. So this is a very good example where we have a prevention strategy where if we can screen people, identify polyps, and remove them, we can greatly reduce the risk of developing colorectal cancer. And one of the reasons we think that colorectal cancer incidence has decreased in older individuals is because of screening programs. And as I mentioned, one of our great concerns about COVID is we saw a significant reduction in the numbers of people getting screened. And so that's very worrisome because unscreened people over time and who have a polyp may experience a transformation of the polyp to a cancer.
Thank you. I would like to thank all our speakers. You've been terrific, I have to say. I want to thank our participants as well, and I'm just going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway from today's program. I'll start with Dr. Benson, then Dr. Faltz, then Ms. Bearden, and then Ms. Russell. And so, Dr. Benson, do you want to provide a takeaway for participants on the call today?
Well, I would just say for those of us who care for people with cancer and are very involved in the cancer research community, it is an incredibly exciting time where through technology and drug development, there are many, many more opportunities to evaluate and treat patients. And all of our advances come from clinical trial participation. So we do encourage individuals to talk with their physicians if there is a clinical trial available for them.
Thank you. And Dr. Saltz?
Yeah, I'm going to emphasize the talking to your clinicians, to your caretakers, whether it's a doctor, a nurse practitioner, physician assistant. Everything about your cancer care involves good communication with your providers in terms of making sure that we know who you are and what matters to you, and that you understand all of your options, both standard and investigational. So don't be shy. There's no such thing as a wrong question or a foolish question. If it's on your mind, we need to know about it.
Thank you. And Ms. Bearden?
Just echoing what we just heard, being in communication with your healthcare team is essential. Each person's unique. Their journey through the treatment's unique. Although we have some idea of what the patient's going to go through, we can help them better if their communication is very transparent and sooner rather than later for us to be able to get to that need as soon as possible. If you have any questions about your healthcare team, ask, who is this? Who do I call for this? Be an advocate for yourself so that you can feel like, hey, I'm in communication. I feel like I'm, understanding everything clearly, and that'll oftentimes give patients a little bit of comfort to feel like that they're connected, that they understand everything, and hopefully feel better at the same time because they'll know what to do when things come up.
Excellent. And Ms. Russell?
I would just echo everyone's sentiments on ensuring that you're really connected in with your care team, but also know that you are not alone even once you leave their offices. You have people out who are very willing and ready to support you during your cancer journey. There are other people out there who are going through the same cancer journey as you, who can provide insight into what they're seeing, what they're hearing, and what they know. We have a Facebook group it's a private Facebook group that has over 13,000 patients, families, and caregivers. It's called Blue Hope Nation. Complete psychosocial support there. Again, our navigators are here. You don't have to do this alone, and we at the Alliance are here to help.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to thank you all, our participants. You've just been amazing, and our speakers have been really phenomenal as well. And I want to remind you, echo what many of you have said, is that you're not alone in coping with cancer, that you're now part of a community of support, and we're all here to help you, from your healthcare team to all of us want to help you in terms of coping. And there'll be many more programs on this topic and topics related to this. So please do take advantage of these services, and I want to thank you for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.